This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Professor Mark Denbo from Seton Hall Law School about a recent New York Times article titled, One in Seven Detainees Rejoin Jihad.
Front page story on the day that Obama gave his Guantanamo speech. A front page story that got it completely wrong. Was it a mistake? Was it on purpose? Listen to Mark Denbo and you decide.
We'll also speak with attorney David Reams, who represents 16 Guantanamo detainees from Yemen.
Has it really gotten better at Guantanamo since President Obama has taken office? Will President Obama simply add some bells and whistles to what is already a dastardly preventive detention scheme?
Stay with us.
We want to take a short segment here to remember our friend and comrade, Alan Berkman, who passed away June 5th at Sloan Kettering Memorial Hospital. He had been fighting recurrent bouts of cancer for 30 years, checked into Sloan Kettering, hoping against hope, risking a stem cell transplant. He had two forms of cancer. He knocked one out, and they were planning to use chemo to knock out his stem cells and give him some fresh stem cells, hoping that that would work and he could, in a sense, be reborn. He was 63 years old. Alan had served 8 years in prison. He was a medical doctor, movement activist, Columbia University, SDS, anti-war movement, Wounded Knee. He had been active in the poor communities as a doctor here in New York City. The way he went to prison was this. One of the people that was involved in that botched bank Brinks robbery up in Rockland County came to him for treatment. He treated her, and then when the police came around asking who his patients were, he wouldn't tell. And willy-nilly, that led him to avoid going in front of a grand jury. He went underground, eventually was picked up, tried, convicted, and given a long sentence. When he was in prison, he self-diagnosed a cancer. And that's when Bill Kunstler and Ron Kuby came in. The prison authorities wouldn't treat him. They really wanted him to die. Communist, a friend of black people, a Jew, they were going to ignore him. And it was a tremendous legal effort to get him medical treatment. They operated on him while he was handcuffed to a gurney. And when they got through with this deep stomach surgery, which cuts all your muscles in your stomach, they took the handcuffs off and made him get up and walk back. So that's the kind of treatment he had for 8 years, four of them in solitary confinement. He came out of that, and this is what's so extraordinary. He came out of that, and he ran an AIDS hospice up in the Bronx for years, and then was asked by the Mailman School of Public Health to become a professor of epidemiology at Columbia, where he had gone to medical school. He did that, and in 1997, along with David Hoos, another doctor who was a professor at Columbia, they founded HealthGap. Health Gap. The gap was this, that it cost between $10,000 and $15,000 to get the AIDS cocktail antiviral medicine to prolong your life if you had AIDS. And the reason that it cost so much is that the big pharma had a lock on the patents. And Alan, along with people from ACT UP and Housing Works, formed a political organization. They were able to figure out how to get around these intellectual property rules. Alan didn't have much respect for private property. And they were able to get these drugs produced for $87 a year. Right now, as we're speaking, 4 million people around the world are taking those drugs, thanks in part to Dr. Alan Berkman. So he was quite an extraordinary person, quite a lovely, sweet man, and a tough man. And I wanted to ask you, Heidi, to read a note that we had from our fellow Lawyers Guild attorney, Linda Bakel, who was close with Filiberto Ojorrijos, who Alan met in prison. And then, Michael, I was going to ask you if you'd read something from Mumia Abu-Jamal, who Alan also knew in another prison. But Heidi, read what Linda had to say in her reflection on Alan.
Alan Berkman was a fighter, the kind of fighter who is gentle and quiet and fights to the death, the kind of fighter who loves poetry and all the other expressions of life that comes at us fast and mysterious and huge and blossoming and totally, totally beyond our comprehension. Unfair. Alan was a doctor who happened to be locked up with another revolutionary, probably many. But this one was his jail neighbor and didn't feel well. He had a heart problem. "No problem," said the jail. "Big problem," said Alan. "He needs surgery now." And so we got him surgery. Not easy, but it happened. A triple bypass. Filiberto Ojeda Rios knew he owed his life to Alan Berkman and never stopped giving thanks for that twist of quirk that is the backside of unfair that put them in the same jail at the same time. Alan was a gentleman. He saved many lives. I am furious that he lived to see his work, his saving of this unique and precious life, undone by FBI sharpshooters. But I know that he also took great pride in knowing that he contributed to the return of this independence leader to his homeland, his family, his people, and for a brief time, an ordinary life as a man who played dominoes with the townsfolk of Hormigueros. We live and love and lose and go on loving and losing as long as we live. The dead, we carry them with us. That was from attorney Linda Bakiel in Puerto Rico.
And Michael, you have the tribute that Mumia wrote from his jail cell on Alan. Mumia met Alan when they were both in jail in Philadelphia some 20 years ago.
Mumia Abu-Jamal writes about Alan Berkman. It opens, "Doc, I had a distinct pleasure of hanging out with Doc many years ago in Philadelphia. Prison is hardly a place to find any kind of pleasure, but that was the sensation when one saw Doc among the people there. For he helped everyone who came his way, selflessly, openly, humanely, in a way quite rare for such a milieu. He deeply resented the treatment he and other prisoners received, but his passion for freedom, for a revolutionary change, for life itself, radiated like a beacon. He was quite ill from his cancer treatments, not to mention the stress from upcoming trials, yet he rustled up the strength, the will, to run, to go out into the sun, and to inspire young men around him to stand up. After his liberation, those life-giving energies went into his patients, many of them AIDS sufferers, who couldn't have found a better healer and ally. Certainly, hundreds of men remember him from Holmesburg Prison with admiration, love, and respect. I'm certainly one of them. Mumia Abu-Jamal."
Dahlia, it's good to have you with us again. We haven't had an update too recently on the case of Troy Davis.
Well, listeners will remember that Troy Davis is on death row for killing a Georgia police officer, Officer McPhail, almost 20 years ago in 1984. The basic story is since the trial, 7 of the 9 witnesses recanted. One of them who didn't recant is the primary alternative suspect. And there is absolutely no physical evidence linking Troy Davis to the crime. Unfortunately, he has been unable to obtain a new trial, examining the recantations and the new evidence for his innocence. So he is unfortunately still on death row with an execution imminent. The U.S. Supreme Court is taking a look at Troy's petition for a new trial, but there's not a lot of hope there. There is, however, some new hope. The DA is Larry Chisholm. He was elected in 2008, and he was elected on a platform of transparency and fairness. And so there are actions that we will link on lawanddisorder.org asking him to reopen the case. That's happening through Amnesty International. Now, the NAACP, the president of the NAACP, Ben Jealous, recently visited Troy in prison, and he was very surprised to discover that news media has been unable to get to Troy, major news media outlets like 60 Minutes, Dateline, and the AP. And so while other individuals in similar circumstances on death row have been able to speak to mass media, Troy Davis has not. And one can only imagine that the Georgian authorities just don't want his story out there. They don't want the general public to know. So the NAACP is asking individuals to write into Georgia authorities, asking them to allow Troy Davis to speak to the media. So we will link that NAACP action on lawanddisorder.org as well. So this is really the case with 9 lives. Troy has faced execution and come within days of it several times. And so we are continuing to push for justice in this case so that the evidence can really be heard.
Dahlia, I cannot imagine the psychological effect this is having on Troy.
I understand that it's very, very difficult. He says he's become a lot stronger during the course of things, but you can imagine coming within days of your death again and again and again, and the courts failing to look at the evidence that you are innocent. He said, 20 years ago, I turned myself in voluntarily because I believed that the system would do me right, that they would, I'd go through the court system, but the court system would look at the evidence fairly. I would be proven innocent because I didn't do anything. And that's turned out to be opposite because of the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which really prioritizes finality in a death penalty case over fairness, over taking more time to get to the heart of the matter and examining new evidence, examining recantations like this. That's really preventing him from getting his day in court.
In another instance of the New York Times giving lie to its statement, it prints all the news that's fit to print. On May 21st, the Times published a front page lead story titled, One in Seven Detainees Rejoined Jihad. That headline appeared on the same day that Obama was giving his speech on what he planned to do with the Guantanamo detainees. The number 1 in 7 was used by Cheney in saying Guantanamo has to remain open. Don't let them into the United States. Don't let them out of Guantanamo. The journalist Elizabeth Buemiller got her statistic from a Pentagon report that stated that 74 prisoners released from Guantanamo had, quote, returned to terrorism. Of course, the headline as well as the content failed to note much of that article failed to note that most of the people had never been convicted of terrorism to begin with. In addition, the 1 in 7 was a gross exaggeration. After a lot of pressure by the Center for Constitutional Rights, FAIR, as well as others, the Times was forced to eat crow. The public editor issued a long report criticizing the Times and comparing the coverage to that that led up to the Iraq War. Today, we're pleased to have with us Seton Hall law professor Mark Denbow, who over the last 4 years has made studies of the public documents of who is at Guantanamo and what they have done. His reports demonstrate, particularly the headline, had no resemblance to accuracy. Welcome, Mark, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Mark, can you describe just briefly some of your work statistically that you've done over the last couple of years or even more, looking at who's at Guantanamo, what they've been accused of, what the government says?
Yeah. One of the problems, I think, for the government is once you had a lot of lawyers representing people and then they stayed all rights of lawyers to do anything, lawyers found other things to do. And I was able, with a group of Seton Hall law students, to go through the data that the Associated Press produced through a FOIA application. And in going through it, with no real expectations of what we were going to find, my students are the ones who discovered that only 4% of those in Guantanamo were picked up by U.S. forces, and 86% were in for bounties in Afghanistan and Pakistan. That was their discovery.
Now that's just remarkable, I should just say. I mean, I know you've had that out for a couple of years, but that's the shocker. I mean, all these so-called people picked up by the U.S., and then it's essentially a bounty system.
It's a bounty system, and I think you can add to the fact that that means that we are totally dependent for evidence against these people on the intelligence gathering and criminal justice system of Pakistan and Afghanistan tribal chieftains and warlords. That's why they can't possibly prove their cases. They don't have the evidence.
Sure, it's about torture a little bit, but it's not really. It's about the fact that these guys were picked up for money. Can you just give us an example of what kind of money, bribes, were paid?
Well, apparently the brochures they handed out were ones that would, the money didn't seem that significant to the U.S. It's, $5,000 per person. But it turned out that first, if you had four or five Arabs in a truck on the Pakistani border, that was $20,000 or $25,000. But more importantly, their brochures made it clear that with $5,000, you could feed your village, as it said on the brochure, for a year. You could buy cattle. You could take care of your family, get medical bills, and you could build schools in your town for one $5,000 bounty. so that apparently $5,000 will sort of work as a stimulus bill of gargantuan proportions in these small little villages.
Now, can you repeat the statistic again of the number of people when you did your study that were really picked up by as a result of bribery?
Well, I think so. I mean, the first statistical issue that was so compelling was the fact that 55% of those in Guantanamo were never once accused of ever committing a hostile act. And that of the 100% who were picked, only 4% were picked up by U.S. forces, and that all of the rest were picked up by other people or turned in for bounties. It's not absolutely certain whether every one of the 96% was turned in for bounties. We only know that most of them were, because the government didn't recognize or identify in particular which ones did it. One of the examples that I think is most telling about all these numbers is, and I'm giving this verbatim because it's embedded in my memory, one of my students walked in, quite a conservative student, and said, "I don't get it. Where's Mr. Big?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "We're going through these. What about this guy?" And he reads out, and it says, so this person was conscripted. This is the U.S. allegations. Conscripted by the Taliban to be an assistant cook. And then the next section is, when the Northern Alliance attacked, he surrendered. Remember I said that only 55% were not accused of hostile acts? This person is one of the 45% who was.
Oh, my gosh.
His hostile act was surrendering to the Northern Alliance. And my student looked at me, and he says, "Okay, where's Mr. Big?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "We have the assistant cook. At least, where's the cook?" He said, "We have the sous chef. Where's the chef?"
And wasn't Cheney that said the people in Guantanamo are the worst of the worst?
Right. Well, that turned. Cheney did. Rumsfeld did.
They all did.
And they were saying that they were confusing the worst of the worst with a what would now be an unconstitutional perp walk, where all they did. I mean, their big mistake was bringing in a random bunch of people and then putting them in orange jumpsuits to show they had. We're winning on the war on terror.
This whole thing is like a show detention facility, except for the people there.
Oh, yeah, except for those people, most of whom are still chained to the floor.
It's a show trial without a trial.
Right, right. The show trial is false advertising.
So, Mark, now I want to bring you up to where we are right now. I know you've done other studies, and it's been probably some of the most crucial evidence we get out there. I think you're planning another one soon. But I remember waking, I think it was May 21st, a couple of weeks ago, when I saw the front page lead article in the New York Times saying 1 in 7, quote, returns to the fight of the Guantanamo people, the 500 or so who have been released. That was the same day that President Obama give his Guantanamo speech. And I read the article, one of the Guantanamo attorneys and working with the Center for Constitutional Rights, in real disgust, not only because I thought it was setting up a speech that Obama could get away with, saying, well, I have to be careful returning people and all this stuff, but also in part of this fight that's going on right now with the right against releasing any Guantanamo people at all, much less into the U.S. So I'm interested in, first, what did that story say, and what happened since then, and what you're thinking of doing?
Well, if you woke up with disgust, I woke up feeling disgusted and ashamed because I was quoted in that article.
I remember that.
And as a matter of fact, the reporter called me for 2 days in a row. She said, "I'm under enormous pressure from my editor." And she kept calling me back and dealing with questions about it. For instance, one of the quotes they attributed to me was that we never said there weren't bad guys. And I was saying, in Guantanamo. She took that to mean we never said there weren't bad guys who were released. And I said to her, I called her the next day, and I said, "That's so unfair." And I said, what I said was, even a stopped clock is right twice a day.
Yeah.
And they're bound to have had some bad guys in Guantanamo. And she said, "I can't say that about the stopped clock."
Wow.
And then she also told me the Pentagon was saying that they couldn't release this information because they were being influenced by politics. And I said, well, at least point out that the Pentagon's agreeing that politics prevents them from publishing the truth, whatever it is. And she said, "I can't say that." And I said, well, I just said it. You can include that. And she didn't.
And this is Elizabeth Bumiller is the reporter?
Yes.
Bumiller is the reporter.
I must add one other thing. When she called me up after the story was done and online, she wanted to do, I think, some supplemental point to it. I believe she had some phrase for it. And, of course, the discussion, she said to me, she said, well, where do you get that information about the Uyghurs and the Tipton Three? And I said, it's in the Defense Department's press release.
This is information about the fact that...
that they were counting Uyghurs as released detainees who returned to the fight. And they were counting the Tipton Three from England who were returning to the fight solely because they had made a documentary. And that they were counting these five Uyghurs who had been released at that time, even though they were still in an Albanian mountain village because their lawyer had written an editorial.
Yeah, they have a loose definition of jihad.
Right. They included it in anti-American propaganda is how they included it.
But let me ask you, what did she say when you said that to her? You have these three Tipton guys who the claim is they returned to the fight because they were in a movie, and you have the five Uyghurs whose lawyer wrote an op-ed. What did she say to that?
Her statement was, remember the article started, the press release started by saying 30 people have returned to the fight. And then they listed the Tipton Three and the five Uyghurs and seven named people at the bottom. And she said, well, you don't know that the Tipton Three and the Uyghurs are necessarily part of the 30. And I said, if that's true, then they've said 30 people returned to the fight and they've identified seven. And I said, and in fact, the only fair reading of something that is syntactically not specially clear has to be that they're part of the 30. And I said, by the way, the seven they named, two of the seven were never in Guantanamo. And one of the remaining four, they've since, he's apparently recovered because he's never shown up on a list of recidivist detainees in the three succeeding ones. And she said, and she's asking me, she said, I didn't see this. And I said, it's in the report that we submitted in December of 07, and it is an appendix, and that's what the report was about. Now, she said, well, it doesn't have Pentagon stationery. I said, no, they only published this literally on white paper with no letterhead, but it's from their site. We've downloaded it, and we've got it. They've since removed it, but, of course, my students are good enough to get it and keep it. And I said, you know, I'm still upset that no one has ever bothered to read that story. Now, that's come up in different contexts, because I am still sort of stunned at the one thing the press doesn't do is read press releases.
We're speaking with Professor Mark Denbo from Seton Hall Law School. Mark really blew the jams off the door on this crooked New York Times story. It's a crooked story that people at Guantanamo, when released, went back to jihad. It's reminiscent, Mark, of the lead-up to the Iraq War when Judy Miller was feeding Pentagon propaganda to the public that all the BS that Bush was saying about how the Iraqis were responsible for 9/11 and so on, and therefore we had to go after Iraq. We have friends, Bill Schaap and Ellen Ray, that used to edit a journal called Loot, Lies of Our Times, and this is a story that should go in there if the journal was ever resurrected.
Sure.
The story was 1 in 7. There was then... of course, the Obama speech. And then there was this huge outcry among us, among the Guantanamo attorneys. FAIR was very important in writing to the public editor, et cetera. And eventually, the Times actually took some action, a number of different things. Can you talk about what was the first? And then there was a piece by the public editor as well.
I know a little bit about that in the sense that the public editor did call me. And we had several conversations. And then we ended up publishing another report responding to it that he referenced. There were a couple of interesting things about it. First, when he called me, the group that he was reporting to as having been generating the most pressure was the Center for Constitutional Rights. And Shane Cadidial had written some things to the public editor, and the public editor was talking to me about that. I was amused to notice that that didn't get cited, but that our piece did, and FAIR's did. But the public editor had certainly been pressured by many people. He and I spoke extensively, I mean really a long time. We both agreed that it wasn't fair to compare Elizabeth Bumiller to Judith Miller. She wrote one story and she may have been duped, but there were clear pressure from her editors to do it. Well, I'm talking to her editors are calling up and she has to hang up on me and call back. And so I think it'd be a little harsh to blame her for this. But it's clear that that piece the public editor wrote made it very clear that, and he ended up saying that it was reminiscent of the Times' coverage of the lead-up to the Iraq War, the way they were covering the entire Guantanamo story.
And what did he? What did the public editor find had been wrong in the article on the 21st?
You know, I mean, I think everybody agrees the headline was grotesque. And everybody noted that the story came out the morning of Cheney's speech, and he managed to have that headline ready in his speech as he gave it in rebuttal to Obama's. But I think everybody agrees the headline really was a disgrace. But that was done by editors, and nobody knows who that did. I think the other part of it was he concluded that the number should have been, I think, instead of 1 in 7, I think it should have been 1 in 20. And I think that's giving the Pentagon a very large benefit of the doubt. But that his position was the headline was wrong. And then the position he gave was that you could read through the story and find points that revealed what would be the appearance of skepticism from the journalist, only in that they juxtaposed some things with a few other things. But I think the clear understanding of the public editor was it was a disgrace both as a headline and as an example of how the press was covering Guantanamo. I was, to be honest, I thought it was an incredibly thorough, detailed, thoughtful piece that by the time you were done, most of the punch had disappeared. So the truth was, it was just a grotesque statement that was wrong and had huge political consequences, and they couldn't unring that bell.
Why do you think the Times was pushing so much to get this story out that day, to get it out with that kind of headline, putting all this pressure on the reporter? What goes on over there?
Well, I don't know, because there are, as you know, there are some New York Times reporters who are very immersed in Guantanamo and national security issues, Scott Shane, Bill Glaberson, and some others who've spent a great deal of time on it. So one of my questions has always been, why did they drop this on the lap of Elizabeth Buemiller, who has just recently been assigned to the Pentagon? But that wasn't my question to ask, but it does raise concerns, I think, about that. And you add to the fact that the editors were pushing her to get this story out.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to understand, actually.
Well, I'm trying to understand that, too. I don't think I'll ever get to the bottom of it, but I happen to know it because I'm a source. She's talking to me, and she keeps saying, oh, these are my editors again. I have to take their call, and we'd come back. I bet that happened 3 times in 1 day, 2 times in another day. And there were the next day. And, of course, I thought the story was going to come out the day before. Mm. And then it was still being developed, and it came out online, I guess, the night before the Cheney-Obama virtual debate. I think it was appalling to see that headline, and I think it was painful to watch it being cited by Cheney as if it were true.
That's what I think. I mean, to me, the damage, even though the public editor did it, and was there another sort of editor's note in the Times.
By the way, the public editor suggested to me that that note in the section the day before his came out might well have been a result of his poking around on the issue, and it was in anticipation of his report, of his piece.
I think that certainly seems right. I mean, the Times is very reluctant to do this kind of stuff, and they don't really love their public editors, from what I can tell.
Right.
But what bothers me a lot is really the barn door was open. When Cheney used the 1 in 7 figure in his speech to respond to Obama, you know, the right wing pushed it. The Democrats pushed it, even some of them. And it's out there. And, you know, you and I and a few other people read the public editor. But it caused, I think, a lot of damage.
Well, I think the damage also preceded that. You know, on January 17th, 3 days before the inauguration, the Pentagon released at a press conference announced that 61 people had returned to the fight, but they gave no names. So you had sort of nameless numbers coming out. We did a report on that also. There are people who filed FOIA requests for the names, and they never came forward with any names on any of those. And we pointed out at the time that that was the 44th time the government had reported numbers of detainees who'd supposedly returned to the fight. And one of the bizarre things was sometimes the numbers would go up, and then sometimes they would drop down. You could have a number of 12, the next report would be 4, then there'd be 24 down to 16. I mean, people were recovering faster than they were actually becoming recidivists. It was just bizarre. So I think one of the big problems has been this is now the 45th time numbers have been set out there. And the 61 number did a lot of damage in January, and it came out just before the inauguration. And now, just as the Obama administration seems to be moving to start to empty out Guantanamo, along comes this story released by the Pentagon. And by the way, this report that that Bumiller was shown was completed and dated April 7th.
Right, and we've never seen it.
Well, it has since been published on the website after it came out. But
right.
Again, you'll find that it's on the website, but it isn't on Pentagon stationery. We've actually attached that as an exhibit in the report that we turned in, I guess, published on Monday. So we have that document there also. It was not published by them until after her story came out and after problems began to arise with her story almost immediately.
This return to the fight business, that's another issue here, of course.
Sure.
Because return to the fight assumes they were in the fight to begin with.
Right. And obviously, many of them never were.
Right. So that whole implication is that all these people are somehow guilty and they, you know, didn't get rehabilitated at Guantanamo and they returned to
right.
the fight. So I found that to be offensive. Is that something you took up with the reporter as well?
Well, yes, and it did, because we talked about the July 07 press release, and I pointed out their definition of return to the fight. It first assumes they'd been in the fight. It actually assumes they'd been in the fight and in Guantanamo, and for many of them, neither is true. First, they've said people return to the fight who are never in the fight, and then they've said people return to the fight from Guantanamo who were never in Guantanamo and never in the fight. But I think probably what's totally missing from this, and I've never been able to make it clear, is that, first of all, none of the people the DOD has listed in any of its 45 times has ever attacked any American troops or Americans or American interests anywhere in the world. The second thing is, with one exception, none of them have ever left the home country to whom they've returned. That is, if there's Moroccans fighting in Morocco over with their government, they're listed as having returned to the fight. But they're not fighting us. It's not clear they're fighting. They're certainly not necessarily fighting. And that's true of Moroccans, of Turks, of Russians, of the Afghanis who have been released. There are a few Afghanis who have been alleged to have returned to the fight. All they've done is rejoin their civil war. And I think it's four people. So it turns out that there's no basis anywhere for anybody to assume that releasing these people endangers anybody but the countries who have voluntarily and freely agreed to take them back.
Mark, what a service you've been providing with your students. Is this through a clinic at Seton Hall?
No. I've decided a long time ago that I wasn't going to make it a clinic because that would require giving credits, which would require people wanting to supervise what we were doing. And the students have happily worked on it totally without any credit for now 4 years. It's kind of a remarkable exercise. I think they've learned a lot about legal education in the sense that law schools spend a lot of time on legal doctrine, but very little time on data analysis and factual development.
There's another observation that one could make. In a totalitarian country, the population generally just suspects the press 100%. They just put a plus where the press puts a minus. But in a country like this where we have allegedly a free press, they can get away with this BS.
Well, yeah, I think I totally agree. I think one of the things that's shocking to me is my view of journalism has fallen because it turns out that I think all I'm doing with my students is what I've always assumed journalists did, which is read documents, analyze them, figure out what they say, and report on it.
That's what I.F. Stone used to do.
I was going to just say.
That I know. Where is he now?
He's at Seton Hall Law School.
Mark, it is remarkable. I agree with you. I.F. Stone just came to my mind, but what also came to my mind is we had 600 attorneys working on Guantanamo and maybe more, and you were the only one who actually went into what the government say about each of these guys, where they get picked up, using the government's own information, and you essentially, from a factual point of view, you just destroyed what the government was saying. And it shows that not, you have all these smart lawyers out there, but again, not doing it. So it's really special.
Michael, but there have been so many different things done by so many different lawyers.
But it's great. It's just, it's really
nice. Well, I appreciate it, and I'm quite proud of it, but I wouldn't want to be misunderstood. Right.
No. But I want you to get now to really give a real clear sense to people where they can go get your reports and what they should read right now, and really repeat it a couple of times.
Okay. If they go to the Seton Hall Law School website, which is, I think, law.shu.edu, there should be a picture there or something with Guantanamo reports on the front page. And if you hit that button, it'll open up all of the reports, including the latest report. They're, I think, in reverse order. And actually, I think this is our 14th report. Some of them are three or four on the same subject, such as this one. But there are some other interesting reports there, too, including a study we did of disciplinary violations by detainees, in which it turns out they've had fewer disciplinary violations than anybody could imagine. That is, two-thirds of the detainees never did anything, one-third did one thing, and usually it's spitting. That's an interesting sidelight. But if they would, I would love it, my students would be flattered if they would go to law.shu.edu. I think it would be an act of kindness to my students to have people read it, even if journalists won't.
Well, that's great. And we'll list it on our website. I just think the work has been great. And really, every time I read one of those Times reports, I know that Mark Dembo and Seton Hall students will be there. So thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
President Obama has held on to the power to allow for a preventive detention system that would indefinitely jail terror suspects in the United States without a trial. In a number of Guantanamo habeas corpus cases, the U.S. government's arguments set up a framework to give the president power to hold terror suspects indefinitely without charge or trial. This is the same broad executive power wielded by the Bush administration that essentially defines a police state. It would be a total disaster if Congress were to pass a preventive detention regime into law, say concerned civil rights lawyers. Attorney David Reams joins us today. He represents 16 Guantanamo detainees from Yemen.
David Reams, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good morning.
David, you have been representing Guantanamo detainees for quite a while. Can you just give us a bit of background? When did you start? Who do you represent?
Well, I really started in the spring of 2004 doing amicus curiae work in the Hamdan case, representing retired generals and admirals who took the position that it was imperative to apply the Geneva Conventions to the men at Guantanamo. Then in the summer, after the Rasool decision came down, recognizing the right of the men to file habeas corpus, one of my friends and colleagues called up CCR and said, how can we help? And CCR doled out 13 Yemenis for us, and we've been representing them ever since July 2004. And along the way, we've picked up a few more Yemenis, an Algerian, and a Pakistani. I'm even helping out on an Azerbaijani matter.
David, when you picked up those cases, you were working at a major law firm, Covington & Burling. Can you just tell us where you are right now?
Well, if I may also provide some background on that, right now I have my own nonprofit litigation firm, a human rights litigation firm called Appeal for Justice. I have had that organization up and running since July of last year, when it became clear to me that I could no longer continue as a partner at a corporate law firm. Covington & Burling is the firm that I worked at, and dedicated as it is to pro bono work, I had really just lost interest in the corporate work that I was doing, and you can't be a lawyer at a corporate law firm and not do some corporate work.
So, that makes sense.
And the reason that happened was that over the 4 years that I was doing Guantanamo work, I would come back from Guantanamo and just think on the way back, nothing else matters to me. Nothing else has any significance to me. Nothing else has any meaning to me. And when you come back from Guantanamo and have to turn to an IBM pension case, it just kind of doesn't compare, at least for me. And I gradually lost interest in that work as the human rights work took over my life and my interests. Here I am.
It's a wonderful story, David. Now, I have a question. Are you allowed to say from where you're broadcasting, David?
Sure. I am right now in a facility called the Secure Facility in Arlington, Virginia. This is a facility that the government set up to hold our interview notes and exhibits and client letters that are deemed to be classified information. And this is where we have to prepare briefs that include such information, and it's where we are preparing our answers to the government's evidence against our clients. It's sort of not a very pleasant place to work. The window blinds are drawn, and it's just sort of a dreary place. Given that the government's treating this information as classified, which I think is really an overreach, but there it is. This is where we have to be.
Now, David, I know we all, in a way, I'm not sure about you, I don't want to characterize it, but looked forward, of course, to the new administration and our hopes for our clients at Guantanamo. Can you give us some sense of how you look at the first 4 months of the administration and then go into some of the particulars?
That really raises two subjects. The first is the litigation, and the second is the work that the administration is doing. With respect to the litigation, it's obvious that the administration says, and the Justice Department says, we're going to maintain the litigating positions that we had before we came into office. This seems to be true across the board in other national security areas, in the immigration area. The government is just going to continue to play real hardball with us, and its main strategy is to obstruct the habeas cases. So we are struggling exactly as much as we did before the administration came in. And I must say, in this context, as well as other national security contexts, the problem with what the administration has done, it essentially overthought the issue and decided to proceed in such a deliberative and such a deliberate fashion that it gave the other side a chance to mobilize into a very effective campaign of scaring the American people against admitting any of the prisoners into the United States, even those who have been cleared. And the result is that we can't reach agreements with European countries, even though they might be willing to take some prisoners, because the European countries say, hey, if you're not going to take them, why should we take them? So there's sort of a stalemate here, which I think Obama's tried to break by bringing Golani into the U.S. for trial on the 1998 embassy bombings in Tanzania.
He's the one that was just brought into New York, is that right?
That's correct. He had been indicted in 1998, and this really is the first instance in which somebody's been brought from Guantanamo into the U.S. for criminal trial rather than military commission trial. But that's sort of a digression or a footnote. The problem is we've got this very effective scare campaign against bringing prisoners into the U.S., and as long as that remains the sentiment, we can't get things done with Europe. That's my perception. And so Obama's sort of backed himself into a corner where he's pledged to close Guantanamo, but he doesn't have anywhere to send the prisoners. So the administration really should have taken some decisive steps very early on in the term, within a couple of weeks. It could have taken advantage of the Bush administration's determinations that 60-odd men were fit for release, but it didn't. It undertook a case-by-case review. So here we are now in June, a year after the Supreme Court said that the men could bring habeas cases, and they're still here. 5 months after the administration said, we're going to look at these men case by case and determine who can be released, President Obama's only released two men. It's a very difficult situation. It's a frustrating situation, and it's a situation that nobody really expected under Obama.
You've been to Guantanamo recently, and I know you had one very, very serious incident. Can you describe what happened with one of your clients when you were with him?
You're referring to my client Adnan Latif, who is a Yemeni with very severe psychological issues and also a variety of neglected medical conditions. He's now in the psych ward, which the military euphemistically calls the behavioral health unit. He's tried to commit suicide on a number of occasions that we know about, at least half a dozen. He is a very intelligent young man. He writes beautiful poetry, and in his moments of lucidness, he's quite self-aware and quite astute. That being said, he's also troubled. And at the last meeting I had with him, we were talking as usual, but he, under the table, he had chipped off a piece of the formica and started sawing into the vein in his wrist, into his left wrist. And at a certain point, he said, I have a gift for you. I want you to have something to remember me by, because he's expecting to die. And he threw a small cup of his blood at me, which drenched me from head to my knees. And I was surprised more than anything else. I said to him, why did you do this? Why did you do this? It was a very chaotic situation. And he said, this isn't against you. And I believe that. But it was a very surprising situation.
David, there have been other suicide attempts that the military continues to deny as suicide attempts and say it's just self-harm. And there have been some deaths.
That's a very good point. And I always like to emphasize that although my client Adnan is in the psych ward, there have been four other suicides of men who were not in the psych ward. It's a general problem of hopelessness and despair for men who don't understand why they're there and can't see any way out. The government does try to euphemize these suicides. In some cases, they call them an act of war against the U.S. I think the theory is that if they commit suicide, then they will draw very critical attention from the rest of the world, and that's why it's warfare. And in other instances, they dismiss the suicide attempt either by saying this was a minor wound or it was self-injury. So they do try to minimize it, but I think that over 30 prisoners are currently on hunger strikes and being force-fed through the nose, nasogastric tubes. And from everything I can tell, the administration of the tube feeding is itself a form of torture, the way it's administered. And this is to break hunger strikers and to discourage others from hunger striking.
I want to remind our listeners, we're talking to David Reams, a lawyer for many Guantanamo detainees and from the nonprofit Appeal for Justice. David, I'm sure you listened to the speech that President Obama made on May 21st concerning the so-called five categories of Guantanamo detainees, as well as his mention of how people were going to be tried. I'm particularly interested in your take on what I would call the fifth category, which we refer to as preventive detention. What your opinion is about that, whether you think there's people at Guantanamo who should be preventively detained, claim that some people can't be tried, what should happen?
The idea that people can be preventively detained is fundamentally inconsistent with the idea of habeas corpus, because under habeas corpus, the government has to establish that it has a legal and factual justification for detaining you. And President Obama, in his executive order, recognized that with respect to this category of individuals, habeas cases would continue. That's sort of a technical point in a certain sense, but it's very important because people do have to have a right to challenge their detention. And the government should not be relieved of its burden of justification. The government wants to do this basically as a status offense, but I think that's inconsistent with due process as we know it, and nobody would want to be in that situation. And the fact that we're only applying it to foreign nationals held at Guantanamo is telling, because it's an admission that it wouldn't be legitimate if it were done with us. In addition, I think that the idea of preventive detention is, it's an idea that sort of goes too far analytically, because if you can preventively detain people, why try them at all? It makes a mockery of having trials, because you can keep them in without trials. So I think it's a very bad idea, and I think it's a bad precedent. I'm afraid that the Obama administration will pursue legislation that will essentially be jurisdiction stripping legislation, denying the prisoners the right to the writ of habeas, because I think that's the only way it can be done.
If you had your druthers, and let's say you were the Attorney General instead of Holder, what policies would you pursue?
That's an excellent question, because we often discuss the Guantanamo problem in the abstract. You have these five categories and so forth. But if you look at the men who are at Guantanamo, you quickly realize that 40% of them are Yemenis, about 100 out of the 240 men. This is a diplomatic problem, not a problem of case-by-case review or legal proceedings. Most of the, I dare say all of the prisoners who have been released from Guantanamo have been released on the basis of diplomatic agreements with the home countries. 90% of the Saudis have gone home. 90% of the Yemenis remain. So I think the first thing I do is recommend strongly to the president that this problem be solved diplomatically with Yemen, because you instantly take care of a large percentage of the men who are already there. The second policy I'd recommend is that prisoners be brought into the United States. And I'm not just talking about those who have been cleared by courts. I'm talking about other men who haven't had their habeas hearings. There's no diplomatic out, and we don't want to keep them at Guantanamo. And I would do that despite the political opposition. I think I would do it as a fait accompli. I definitely oppose the idea of bringing these men in and putting them in maximum security prisons, because that assumes the conclusion that they're terrorists. If you're going to keep them in any kind of prison, I'd suggest some facility where life is not that oppressive. I don't know how to be more specific. I don't know whether that's a medium security facility or not, but I think that you can't send them to Florence, Colorado, which is where Moussaoui's kept. And I think that's where some demagoguery has been going on. So once you bring these men in, then you have a chance to achieve the diplomatic solution. I know that sounds very long-winded, but I'm looking at this in a practical sense and not a theoretical sense.
Attorney David Reams, it makes me proud to have you as a colleague. It's just extraordinary what you've been able to do.
David, we talked a little bit about President Obama's recent speech where he spoke about prolonged detention, preventative detention. What does this mean for the future of the individuals at Guantanamo? And beyond that, what does it mean for future presidents and individuals who might be detained anywhere in the world?
Well, let me go to your last point first, because it points up that the administration has denied habeas rights and is fighting habeas rights for prisoners at Bagram, and I suppose by implication anywhere outside of Guantanamo. So I think that's a very basic problem. The preventive detention issue is really going to depend, I think, on what kind of legislation the administration can get Congress to pass. And I think any time you go into Congress on this issue, you're going to get pulled to the right. And what's going to end up happening is something that is really quite awful. So that's really the answer to the question. I guess the only thing I'd say otherwise is that any authorization of preventive detention, like any restriction on speech, is a precedent that cannot be limited. Once you say that people pose a danger, that becomes a rationale that really can't be cabined. In the case of civil commitment for mental incompetence, you've sort of got a category that is defined by an inherent characteristic of the person. There is no inherent characteristic of the men at Guantanamo. Having a propensity for violence isn't an inherent characteristic. It's one that you could have if you are a rapist or a murderer or so forth. So I think that this is just another long-winded way of saying you can't limit the precedent of preventive detention to the Guantanamo or War on Terror situation. We had the McCarran Act, Title II, of which authorized the U.S. to set up internment centers, repealed only in 1988. And what's happened before can happen again.
Well, David, thank you very much. And I know you're going off to Guantanamo for 2 weeks. Just the last thing, how many times have you been to Guantanamo?
I've been there about 20 times, and it's the only way that I can really get a Caribbean vacation.
Remarkable, David. Well, thank you very much. I mean, your whole history here has just been amazing to all of us and really admirable.
Thank you.
Thanks,
great
David.
To have you on Law
Bye-bye.
And Disorder. Thank you, David.
David.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.